Coming up on Boston Public Radio, 8 weeks and counting to a new governor, new attorney general, new congressman from the North Shore. The big winners in those races, Charlie Baker, Martha Coakley, Seth Moulton, and Maura Healey all join us. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Does the Joan Rivers case send a cautionary note about those new, cheaper medical clinics springing up in our neighborhoods?
Hours before the president gives his speech on ISIS, security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us in studio, and the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy, on yesterday's elections, as well as on many newspapers taking the word red out of the Washington Redskins. Then we're going to ask you, as Art Kaplan says and the studies probably indicate, if you watch action-packed movies, you devour not only the big box of buttery popcorn, but the box it came in as well. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jim.
On to the finals. So 688,109 Bay State voters have spoken. Joining us to sort through the relatively empty ballot box are Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio. Shannon is a former state treasurer and gubernatorial Democratic nominee. Charlie runs Chipio Strategies. He was a policy advisor in the Romney administration. And as they are here over the next 35 minutes, we will be joined on the phone by last night's big winners, Charlie Baker, Martha Coakley, Seth Moulton, and Maura Healey will join us as well. Shannon and Charlie, good to see you both.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Hi. So, Shannon O'Brien, some of us, including myself and probably you, have been complaining for years about how we can't elect any women statewide.
Now I'm really getting sick of them.
Yeah. I mean, now we got Martha Coakley in the running for governor. We got Deborah Goldberg in the running for treasurer. We got, of course, Maura Healey, attorney general. Suzanne Bump for auditor. She's running against a woman, St. Albans. Her name is Patricia St. Albans. And Karen Pulido, of course, a Republican running for lieutenant governor.
And don't forget down in Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo. Yeah.
Took on pensions, which is unbelievable. Charlie can
treasure.
Excited about that.
Yeah, she's great.
But what happened?
I think that it was very clear when you saw a lot of the advertising in a lot of the races very much directed towards women. The polling was telling you that and I don't know what the numbers finally are, but that they thought that anywhere from 55% to 60% of the voters in the Democratic primary would be women. And I think that you'll see similar numbers, not maybe that high in the general election, but I think you're going to see that people will be directing their comments towards women. Women will make the difference in this vote, in this final election. And so I think you're going to see a lot of women's issues.
But it's interesting to me that just the switch flipped like that, you know, after years of having the worst record in this. Well, we haven't elected anybody yet, but, you know, in the country for electing women, that it's just suddenly this.
Still one of the worst. By the way, currently it's fine. Still, what, 5 members of the House of Representatives ever? Yes. 1 member of the United States Senate ever? And you were the first, obviously, woman statewide office holder. How many have we had?
Evelyn Murphy was the first statewide
office being elected in her own right. Yeah. I don't mean that to disparage Evelyn Murphy, but she's elected.
Well, what she did was harder. But,
well, whatever it is. In any case, we will have, obviously, the contestants on all sides on, but the Republicans, for the most part, didn't have primaries. Other than Baker and Pulido, who I assume are going to be in a tight rate with Coakley and Kerrigan. Mm-hmm. People are saying, Kerrigan? Who's Kerrigan? We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Right up to November, how do the Republicans' statewide offices beat any of these people except potentially Baker and Pulido beating Coakley and at least in a tight race with Coakley and Kerrigan? How do they win lower offices?
Well, I think that, you know, this isn't the answer I'm supposed to give, but I think the answer is that they don't. I mean, I don't really see very competitive races other than the governor and lieutenant governor.
It's really also, in fairness to the Republicans, and we're going to try to give this as even play as possible, with the casino question being that high profile, with the other ballot questions being that high profile, with the governor's race being that high profile. It's actually a U.S. Senate race, even though no one would know it. I had Markey running for re-election quickly, too. It's almost, there's no air in the room for the Republicans, even if they run great campaigns.
Well, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think that, you know, the only time that there would be in a situation like this is if you go back to a time like 1990, you know, where there's just so much rage and so much anger out there that there's room for several different to care about a lot of different races. But that's the exception, not the rule.
But I'm not sure that there's not, you know, at least some anger out there right now, which is driving things. And I do want to actually get back to your point about who was the first person elected to statewide office and who was. it's one of the – I think the hardest thing, the hardest hurdle for anybody to get past in Democratic politics here in Massachusetts is to win the Democratic primary for a governor. I mean, you have seen not just men – but I mean, not just women, but men, all of these people who should have been the front runners, who would have been the front runners, you know, who are sort of strewn over the course of history. The Democratic primary is generally something so rough and tumble, so tough, so much money spent. It is very, very difficult to kind of get past.
What's your point?
My point is that I think that, you know, I think we're going to be talking a little bit later about Martha Coakley, but I sort of kind of get back to Evelyn Murphy, what an amazing accomplishment it was that she was able to do that. But the accomplishment
– To do what? Be elected lieutenant governor?
To win the Democratic nomination in a hotly contested statewide Democratic primary for statewide office. This is not –
For lieutenant governor?
For governor, lieutenant governor, all of those races when they're contested. I believe that it is
very – So
wait a
second. That's more significant than you being elected the first statewide woman office holder?
Well, it's more significant to me.
Oh, my gosh.
No, me being – the first thing.
So
no,
how does
my
that
point,
translate?
I'm talking about in terms of doing it. I think that running in a Democratic primary for statewide office for a managerial statewide position is very, very difficult.
So Martha Coakley's just done it, and she's just come out. She's won.
Second time she's done it.
As big a margin as we thought she was going to. So how does that theory translate into what happens to her now? She won it when she ran for Senate. She won the nomination. It was not the governor's race.
Pretty strong field, too.
By 20 points.
But I think it's easier for a woman to run. And we've seen this, and I've talked about this before. The Barbara Lee Foundation does a lot of these different focus groups, and they've done studies of women running in statewide offices, but in particular for executive offices, for governor's offices.
So how does her win, and what you just said about this being she's just come through the worst battle,
Charlie, you can leave,
translate
by the way.
Into her race against Charlie Baker?
I think that it means that she comes at this she has just – Charlie Baker just sort of ran around the block right now. She just ran a marathon with 10-pound weights in her shoes, and she won.
Okay.
And people are saying it's only by 6 points. I think what she has done is incredible. I think
this has just gone over the line
into
insanity.
I only said this to tick him off because he was looking kind of sleepy over there.
It was a late night last night. My kids were driving me crazy.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
This is somebody who started this race on third base in terms of money and name recognition.
Martha Coakley, you're talking
about. And she barely slid home under the tag. This is not good. This is not a good sign.
But what about the whole women thing? I mean, not only did Charlie Baker get crushed last time around because women did not vote for him, also you've got – I maintain there's a lot of women that feel very badly about what happened to Martha Coakley. Martha Coakley.
Thank you, Howie.
Sorry, that was a Freudian slip. Martha Coakley, when she was beaten by Scott Brown, especially older women who are reliable voters who may be out for revenge.
Well, but I disagree with that simply because you say they feel bad for what happened to Martha Coakley.
And the
Martha Coakley's wounds were self-inflicted. That was an easily winnable race, and she blew it.
Well, you sound like Don Berwick the other night in the debate. I mean, by the way, as someone who watched that race pretty closely, as did we all, I don't think she ran such a horrible campaign.
In 2010?
Scott Brown was the right person and the right time. By the way, it's not taking anything away from Scott Brown, nor is it take anything away, give something to Martha Coakley. She ran a decent campaign. He just was he needed to be.
Now, here's what I would say about that. I would say that she ran an okay campaign, except for when the momentum started to go the other way, she didn't know what to do, and she reacted very poorly. The last month of that campaign was very, very poorly won. And I would say she's learned from that. She's running a better campaign.
And both – one of the things I've been obsessed with and will continue to be until November unless it changes, why was the turnout not just abysmal, embarrassingly abysmal? Open races. This is not an incumbent running who's going to win in a walkover. Open races for the most important offices in Massachusetts. Nobody voted. How do you explain that?
I think I said this last night doing commentary. I believe that there is sort of an excitement deficit on both sides of the aisle. I think in the Democratic and the Republican, I think that the candidates, both Charlie and Martha, are going to have to talk to people very personally about what this race means for them. None of them is Deval Patrick. None of them is Barack Obama in terms of their soaring rhetoric. But what they have to do is to take their policies and what it means to them. Going to be talking about the gas tax? I want you to tell me, because you know what makes me mad every morning? You want to know what makes me
what
mad?
Makes you
what
mad?
Makes you mad?
What makes me mad is I hate my commute. It makes me cranky. It makes my blood pressure go up. And when we don't have the resources to fix some of the worst crumbling roads and bridges in Massachusetts. I want to know what that's going to mean to me.
You mean
and
connect all these issues to real people's lives?
Connect these issues to real people, because I think you hear about economic policy and we're going to do this and I used to do that. But people want to know in a very real sense, what is this going to mean to me? And that's what they both have to do.
Is that going to fix the turnout deficit yesterday, Charlie Tribune?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. Just as a quick aside, I would say the person I thought, by the way, who did the best job of that and who gave the best speech of his career last night was Steve Grossman. I thought he was
a great speech.
Very classy.
Very passionate, very, very genuine. No, I don't think so. I don't think it will. I think there's a couple things going on. One, you know, we have the one-party state here, and so it just affects everything. And it's gotten worse in the last few years, you know, fault of the Republicans as much as anybody else. And I think that, you know, we don't have a guy like a Deval Patrick or a Bill Weld or somebody who really captures people's attention and really has that kind of charisma this time. So it's a little bit harder.
And I also think that Obama has also driven an awful lot of what has been, you know, creating some excitement and then the excitement of Deval Patrick. And I think that may also be something that is kind of...
That's on the wane.
Yeah,
right now.
On the wane. And, right. And that hope and what that means, no one is able to tap into it. I want somebody to tap into what's my problem.
Shannon O'Brien, former candidate for governor, former treasurer, and Charlie Chippio from Chippio Strategies. What's the issue that's going to dominate this race, Charlie Chippio, the governor's race?
Whew, that's a very interesting question. I still think it's got to be the economic issue going forward, because I still think that as much as the economy has improved, I still think people don't feel secure. I still think the labor numbers are very scary. Places still aren't hiring. If they are, people who are very qualified are still working part-time jobs. So I think it's that kind of economic security issue that is still going to be the top issue.
You agree,
here.
Shannon O'Brien?
I agree, but I disagree on one end, because it's the economy, but it's how it affects, again, everybody.
Yeah.
And whether or not, I mean, one of the issues that Martha Coakley hammered home on last night was that universal pre-K. You know, one of those things that getting kids early on and getting them prepared to do well in school, you know, creates that opportunity intergenerationally over the long term.
Yeah, but it kind of interrupts your one there.
Everybody, yeah, I got one on there.
A lot of people support universal pre-K, but when people say, I'm going to eliminate waste and inefficiency to fund this new program and that new program, that's a problem. I mean, new spending, unless you are really clear, means to the voters big-time new taxes,
right.
doesn't
it?
And we were talking today about Renee Loth, that people have to be honest.
She wrote a piece, former editorial page, Jared Globe wrote a piece in the Globe.
In the Boston
today,
Globe. A very, very good piece about what both Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley have to do, that when you have big ideas, you have to talk about how you're going to pay for them. And I can't agree more that waste, fraud, and abuse. I mean, I can remember coming into the state treasurer's office, and I had run against Joe Malone previously, and I remember him talking about, you just do things more efficiently. And we came in and we found out he actually was hiding money inside of the state
that's the
budget.
Other option.
And pushing, I know, and putting, which is going to become an issue. But I remember being in a debate with him once, and I'm sitting there with John Keller, and I go, you're not telling the truth. I just don't know how you're not telling the truth. And it took, by the time I was governor, to realize that this $1 million surplus
was fictional. You were treasurer, by the way. You didn't quite make it to
by
the governor
time
thing.
I was treasurer.
Yes.
But the fact is, they're going to have to be very honest about not only what these big programs are and what they're going to do to create opportunity for everybody, but how you pay for
right.
it. But my point is that how we have a pretty good economy. There was just a report out last week that has Massachusetts number 5 in the country in terms of states coming back and doing better. But everyone's not feeling it. Everyone is feeling very hammered right now, as Elizabeth Warren would say. And as someone who now has a 15-year-old headed into high school and thinking about what college is, I think that is one of the big issues that people are thinking about. How do
yes.
I afford to pay for a college education? And no one can afford to pay for a college education
that's right.
anymore.
That's right. No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think this idea of having to be honest about how to pay for things, how we're really going to pay for things is critical. That's why one thing I disagree with Charlie Baker on is this whole gas tax thing. I think, you know, we need to pay for these things. But, you know, I would
this whole gas, for those who don't know, the question on the ballot is not to repeal the gas tax.
Right.
It is to repeal the automatic indexing
right.
to the rate of inflation so it'll keep going up over time. Baker is for repeal of that provision, and Coakley is for keeping that provision.
But I would get back to this, the universal pre-K, because here's stuff, you know, this is policy wonky stuff. But, you know, this to me is a little bit of what troubles me about Martha Coakley. You know, it's very easy. You know, all the Democrats spot the same lines about education. The two things that don't offend the teachers' unions, universal pre-K and a longer school day. Okay? But, you know, the reality is that It would be insane to just start universal pre-K and just put it in place, because if you look at these programs, most of them are bad. You have some of them, like AppleTree, for example, this program in Washington, D.C. That's amazing. What we need
why
to
is
do,
it amazing?
And why can't we have it here?
Yeah.
Well, we could. I mean, if we're willing to – well, we can't have it here because it's a charter school network, and we can't do that here because it doesn't matter if you're good. You got to – be on the right side of people, you know, of the people who matter. And so unless you can take these few programs that really work and replicate them, and you're not going to be able to do that at scale tomorrow, that's the only way this is going to work. But this stuff gets lost in campaigns. Yeah. I don't think there's anything we can do about
that. I'm surprised you haven't brought up yet the woman in Rhode Island. We don't want to get away too far away from Charlie Baker.
And she's Italian, too.
She went after woman treasurer in Rhode Island that went after the pension system in Rhode Island and won. And that was
not even mentioned.
But this was not even mentioned in this race. Yep. And that's certainly a place where you could look at saving some money if you wanted to have the
but it's long-term savings.
Speaking of charter schools for a second, one of the themes that I think Charlie Baker is going to sound is he's the candidate of reform. Martha Coakley is the candidate of no reform or anti-reform. Scott Lehigh's been writing the same kind of thing in the Boston Globe. Does that, you know, what, on one level, people want reform, even if they don't know what it is, because they're not happy with what is. But that totally flies in the face, unless it's concrete, to your notion. The people, all they want to know is, how is whatever you're going to do or not do going to affect me in my life? So once again, reform is a grand umbrella thing, doesn't cut it unless you talk about content, right?
Well, I think that people –
or it does.
I think that, A, it is an important issue, especially in light of the O'Brien probation scandal. I think that people
– not Shannon O'Brien. By
not
way.
Shannon O'Brien. Thank you. But I think that there is sort of this feeling out there, and that those were some of the things that Charlie – referenced last night is sort of in general, you know, kind of issues that needed to root out sort of institutional. He didn't use the word corruption, but institutional problems. And
I got to cut you off for 1 second.
That's okay.
Because joining us on the line is the Democratic nominee for governor. That would be the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, Martha Coakley. Martha Coakley, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you very much, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
Hello, Attorney General Coakley, and congratulations as well. But I'll ask you the question. It'll be asked like 19,000 times today. A little bit tighter. Grossman was a little bit closer to you than some had expected. What's that about?
Well, and actually, as we've talked, you know, we weren't paying attention to, you know, those numbers. We were out getting our vote out. We're delighted with the results, frankly. And the important thing is that both Steve Grossman, both last night and this morning, and Don Berwick, last night and this morning at our unity breakfast, said, we're all in this together now. Those numbers, look at the turnout of Democrats in that primary. All of those Democrats believe in the vision that Governor Patrick spoke about this morning. We have not only a vision for a future in Massachusetts as prosperous and fair, but we have plans in order to implement it. And I'm really proud of the team that got elected yesterday. So we're marching forward, and I believe we'll be successful in November.
Martha Coakley, how important is the woman theme? I've heard you tell a woman thing, and you are a woman. I want to make that clear. No, you've told
hard
the story.
To tell on the radio.
I think you made the point. Like, you told the story again of your father saying to you, I think it was your father who said to you when you were getting out of law school or some such thing, sometimes the best man for a job is a woman. I haven't seen you play that up big time. Obviously, Charlie Baker didn't do nearly as well amongst women against Deval Patrick as he needed to do. Is that a central theme, that it's time to have a woman as governor of Massachusetts for you?
Well, I think the theme is that it's time to have the governor who will bring Massachusetts forward for everybody. And so my work is DA, working with kids, working in domestic violence. My work is attorney general, standing up for people about to lose their homes, men and women. You know, this is about more than just that. It is about people who want a fair shot here in Massachusetts. Let me tell you about 50 women who were laid off, between 35 and 50. They were in good jobs. They got laid off. They're still looking for work 12 months, 18 months later. I want to be governor for them. I want to be governor for those kids in high school who are going to look to pay back their college debts, both men and women, because if we're able to give the equal opportunity to people to get ahead in Massachusetts, to get that education, to get a good job, everybody wins with that, and people recognize that. And I really believe what my dad said, sometimes the best man for the job is a woman. I think voters saw that yesterday, frankly. Women particularly said, we want to be involved in our future for us, for our families, for our kids. I think that's a great message for Massachusetts, and I think it's one of the reasons we'll be successful in November.
We're talking with Martha Coakley. She's the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, and she was victorious last night, besting her two Democratic opponents to become the nominee for governor this time around against Charlie Baker. You know, Martha Coakley, one of your colleagues in the Attorney General's office, one of your, I guess you're her boss, Maura Healey, came out of nowhere and beat Warren Tolman handily. Do you think we'll see much of Martha and Maura together on the campaign trail between now and November?
I think you might. Particularly, you know, again, proves the point that, you know, Maura, and I've said this job and this race is going to be one on ideas and organizing. And they had different ideas about the office. They had great debates on it. Maura got very organized. She had a lot of support. Look, Warren Tolman was also a great candidate, as we've said, and I have said about Steve Grossman and Don Berwick. Massachusetts would be honored to have any of them serve as governor. I think that we all share a vision for Massachusetts that is what most voters want here, about opportunity, equality, getting that fair shot. Maura has worked with me. I think she ran a great race, obviously, and voters agreed with that. But look, more importantly, as I look forward to moving ahead to be the governor and work with an attorney general who will also stand up for people and for equality and opportunity, she can hit the ground running. She's going to be able to work with me in a way that will move Massachusetts forward. We have a very strong ticket, by the way. Steve Kerrigan, as lieutenant governor, will be a great partner. I believe that as we have Deb Goldberg as treasurer, this is a lot of new faces and some experienced faces that women, and as Steve said this morning, we've just elected three women, and he said, and a gay guy. This is a new day for Massachusetts.
And a gay woman, by the way.
That's right. Hey.
But he said the good news is that it wasn't news, right? All of them were elected because of the races they run, the ideas they have, the organization that they brought to it. And I could not be more excited about that team and about what we're going to be able to do in the next 55 days on the trail, but more importantly, as governor. And in the governance of what we have for an opportunity in Massachusetts is we turn this economy around for everybody, not just Boston and Cambridge, of course, but the whole state. I've got great ideas about that. I've got a regional economic plan that will work from the ground up. Hey, we're going to invest in our kids and our education.
Martha,
that's what makes us prosperous and fair.
We've got to hold you today. We hope to see you and talk to you many times in the next 55 days. Martha Coakley, the Democratic nominee for governor. Martha, thanks so much for your time.
Saying hi, guys. See you soon.
Thank you very much.
Now joining us on the phone is the Republican nominee for that very same office. His name would be Charlie Baker. Congratulations, Charlie, and welcome.
Thanks, guys. Good afternoon.
Hey, congratulations, Charlie Baker. So I don't know if you heard the Attorney General, Martha Coakley. She was just with us for a couple of minutes talking about the campaign ahead. So what's the Charlie Baker theme that's going to bring you to the corner office after November?
That I have the right experience and the right vision for Massachusetts to deliver a great commonwealth from one end to the other, that I have the plans with respect to jobs and schools and building great communities and bringing balance to Beacon Hill, and I've got the experience as a senior player in the Weldon Cellucci administrations, as a healthcare guy who took a bankrupt healthcare plan and turned it into the number one player in its category in the country, and as a former local official who gets what life is like in local government as well.
So what's wrong with her?
Well, she's proposed billions of dollars in new spending and has made quite clear she's perfectly happy to raise taxes to pay for them. And on a whole bunch of issues where we put out, I think, sort of common sense reform proposals to meet the expectations and the sort of demands of the voters in Massachusetts, she's been pretty silent on all of them. And for me, the most compelling one was the series of common sense reforms we proposed for the probation department after the trial and the scandal, and everybody sort of coming away from that saying, wow, there's a whole lot of people who got jobs there for which they simply knew somebody. They really weren't qualified to get them. And we made some pretty, I think, reasonable proposals with respect to what to do about that. And when Martha got asked about that, her answer was that she thought things were pretty much fine the way they were, which just says to me that she's looking at this from the inside out and not from the outside in. People want to see stuff like that get fixed.
Hey, Charlie, two quick things from me. We're talking to Charlie Baker, the Republican nominee, as of last night for the governor. I'm standing about 3 feet away from a woman who lost the governor's race in 2002, I think in great part because Mitt Romney, that would be Shannon O'Brien, of course, because Mitt Romney
talked... Hi, Shannon.
Hey, Charlie.
Because Mitt Romney talked about the gang of three. Do you want the Senate, the House, and the governor's seat all owned by the Democrats? Is that a central theme for you, or is that an afterthought?
I certainly think balance and bipartisanship on Beacon Hill, there's a lot of bees, is a good thing. And I saw that play out in real terms when I worked there. In the Weldon Scalucci years, we got a ton of really important reform done, cut taxes 27 times, and created an economy that was absolutely exploding. We added 500,000 net new jobs in the 1990s and went from having the highest unemployment rate in the country when we got there to having the lowest unemployment rate by the time Paul Scalucci left to go to Canada. I think there's tremendous power in balance. I've said this before, that there's a constructive friction that comes from that, that gives voters the kind of accountability and the urgency that they deserve. And look at what we've got with one party government up there, guys, and with a whole bunch of, you know, perfectly good people. You got the DCF tragedies and the healthcare connector fiasco and the medical marijuana disaster. And I mean, it's just the compounding pharmacy, the crime lab, the probation piece, which we talked about. And all of it just sort of happens, and everybody brushes it off and moves on.
Hey, Charlie.
It shouldn't work like that.
Charlie, before you go away, what'd you
By the way, I'm not going away, Jeff. I'm going to be around and bothering you all, haunting you for the next few months.
Charlie, what's the major lesson you learned from losing last time to Deval Patrick that you're fixing in your mind this round?
Biggest lesson is run for the office. Talk about why you want the job and why you'd be good at it and what your vision for the Commonwealth is. And frankly, you know, that's all I've been talking about. And the other side, as you may have noticed this morning, decided to go straight negative, straight out of the gate. And I think the reason for that is because they don't have the plans and the vision that we've put forward to move Massachusetts ahead.
Hey, Charlie Baker, congratulations on last night, and we look forward to you bothering us nonstop for the next 55 days.
Thank you, Charlie.
Haunting. Take care, guys.
Haunting. Thanks, Charlie Baker. Okay. So before we go to Seth Moulton, who was the surprising, I would say, victor over an incumbent, first Democratic incumbent to lose here in 22 years, he'll join us in a couple of seconds. Charlie Chipio, what Charlie, I thought, just did quite skillfully, Charlie Baker, mm-hmm. was said, look, Shannon O'Brien goes negative right away. Oh, Shannon O'Brien. Excuse me.
I did not.
Oh, okay.
Shannon O'Brien is
Martha
a ray Cunkley of sunshine.
Martha goes negative right away, but Charlie ignores the fact that early on he says, oh, she's going to raise spending billions of dollars. She's going to raise your taxes. Has no problem for that. Can he do both messages, say I'm running a positive campaign, and then be leveling that charge
Coakley? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that saying that, you know, the other side is going to spend a lot of money and raise taxes, I don't really consider that negative. I mean, you know, negative is the kind of thing that I think we'll get to negative. Don't get me wrong. But I don't see that as kind of as really a negative. I think that's just what you do. I mean, the things like the universal pre-K, things like that, it's going to cost a whole lot of money.
Negative when Martha Coakley says, as she said last night, Charlie Baker is captive of special interests. If she can tick off, and we'll talk to them both a lot about it in the months ahead, is that a negative charge? Or is that, from your perspective, just like it's in his mind factual, she's going to raise taxes and spending, he's a product of special interests? Is that
negative
or no?
To me, and you know, from my own perspective, it is beyond astonishing for any Democrat in Massachusetts, a wholly owned subsidiary of unions in Massachusetts, to call anyone else owned by special
interests. You know
what that
is? That was a negative attack.
Well, I'm not running for anything.
Let me ask you something about the Baker-Coakley thing, too. You know, Charlie Baker, he's the only Republican now. If you're a Republican, no matter how conservative you are, you've got one of the two. How does he finesse this? Because on the one hand, he doesn't want to lose too many of the people that are much more right than he is. On the other hand, he's got to get those suburban
women. He just
women.
Won 75-25 in the Republican primary. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of Republicans stayed home because they mm-hmm. didn't necessarily think that it was worth their while, because the more conservative ilk of the Republican Party was not going to be as well served
yep.
by Charlie, who was a more moderate Republican.
So you don't think he has to worry about it?
I think that what he has to worry about is whether or not I think Martha's biggest challenge is how does she speak to white men? Because I think it's clear she's going to win women. It's whether or not Charlie can reduce, you know, get, as Mitt Romney did, get women to think that Charlie's okay on women's issues and I can vote for him, you know, and then, you know, it's those numbers right there. That's what I, if he can get enough women to come over and support him, he doesn't have to win women, just to get enough to support him.
Speaking of white men, what a segue. We have the winner of the Democratic primary.
And by the way,
primary.
This is radio, just let people know.
I understand.
You are. Okay, all right, yeah.
In the 6th Congressional District, defeated a 9-term incumbent in the Democratic primary. He'll be facing Richard Tesei in the final. Seth Moulton, congratulations and welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Hello, Seth Moulton, the winner of the big shocker of the evening. Before we get to the shocker quality of this whole thing, I got to ask you a question. You mentioned in your victory speech, you're a combat veteran, you're a Marine, you're a white guy. You mentioned in your speech the influence on you of Peter Gomes, who was from Harvard, who's a gay guy and African-American Cape Verdean guy. What was that about? Who is he? Why'd you mention him?
Reverend Gomes is one of my mentors in college, and he talked a lot about the importance of service and how it's not enough just to believe in service or support those who serve. You ought to go serve yourself. And that was really my inspiration, in a way, to serve in the Marines. I looked at different options to serve after college. I looked at the Peach Score. I looked at teaching overseas. But at the end of the day, I had so much respect for the 18- and 19-year-old kids who put their lives on the line for the country that I decided I would do my part as well.
How much of an issue do you think that, as a combat veteran, 4 tours of duty from what I recall, how much of a role do you think that what the president does or doesn't do starting tonight at 9 o'clock is going to play in your race against Richard Tesei, Seth?
Well, I think people are talking about it a lot because people are concerned. People are concerned about the threat of ISIS, but they're also concerned about getting dragged into another ground war in the Middle East. And having more people in Congress with the experience and credibility to understand this issue, of having spent time over in that part of the world, and to ask the tough questions before we make any commitments of American troops is very important.
Do you believe that, unlike the president, that he needs formal authorization from Congress before he proceeds with what we believe he's going to announce tonight?
I think he should. I think that's the role of Congress, and I think he should seek Congress's authorization.
You know, Seth Moulton, this was a very, very tight race. Many people did not think you were going to be speaking as the victor today. When did you get the sense, or maybe you didn't, maybe you were totally stunned too, or did you get the sense that it was turning your way?
Well, I knew all along that we could win. But I think it was over the past couple weeks as I went out in the campaign trail and just heard so many people yearning for change, yearning for new leadership. Look, I respect the congressman for his 18 years of service, but I think people want some new ideas and some fresh leadership, and that's the way we can break the gridlock in Washington, D.C. And I just heard so much of that on the campaign trail that when that poll came out a week ago saying that we were in a dead heat, it was a surprise to a lot of people, but to be honest, it wasn't such a surprise to me.
You, I think, consciously did not mention some of what got Congressman Tierney a little hot water last time around, his wife's involvement, this illegal offshore gambling ring. I assume that was a strategy on your part.
Look, I just wanted to stay above it. And I think what the voters want to hear about is what we can do for them. There's so much work that needs to be done. We need to bring jobs back to the 6th. We have higher unemployment than the rest of the state. We need to ensure educational opportunity for all. And I say that as someone who's still paying his college loans. We need to take care of our veterans. And I say that as someone who gets his health care from the VA. And we need to ensure equality for all, including women in the workforce. Pay equity is a big issue for me. So that's what voters really want to hear about, and that's what I tried to focus on when I was out earning their support.
Hey, so last question for me, Seth Moulton. What do you think is scarier, serving in Iraq or serving in the House of Representatives?
Look, I don't underestimate the challenge of going to Washington, but one of the lessons I learned from the war, even though I disagreed with the war, being over there, I saw the impact that leaders could have. People said to me, Seth, you're going to be one of 155,000 troops in Iraq. What difference can you possibly make? And yet every day over there, I saw the impact that leaders could have when they're willing to stand up, to make a difference, to do the right thing, even when it's difficult or politically unpopular. And I think that's what we need in Washington today.
Hey, Seth Moulton, congratulations. We look forward to talking to you a lot during the campaign. We appreciate your time.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, Seth will be on TV with me at 6 o'clock at NECN and Richard Tesei tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Speaking of someone coming from out of nowhere to be the nominee for a pretty important office, joining us on the phone is the Democratic nominee for Attorney General. That would be Maura Healey. Maura, congratulations.
Oh, thanks so much, Jim. Great to be on with you both.
Thank you for calling in, Maura Healey. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Seth Moulton a couple of seconds ago. You really clobbered Warren Tolman. Everybody loves Warren Tolman, and he's a great guy. But you, I mean, 62 to 38 or whatever it was, that's a huge win. Did you have any sense it was going to be this big?
No. I mean, candidly, I didn't know that the margin was going to be what it was. That said, I felt good going into it. I felt like we had a really energized group of volunteers and activists out there, folks who'd worked hard across the state day in and day out for many months now. I worked hard, and people were really galvanized. So, look, I was obviously really thrilled, honored, and humbled by what the voters did yesterday for me. And for this campaign. And, you know, we continue to fight on here. We've got the big test coming up in November, but it's absolutely thrilling. And I'm just so humbled and grateful to the voters here in Massachusetts.
By the way, she's running for Attorney General against the Republican, John Miller. We will speak to John, I'm sure, plenty during this campaign. I'm guessing you were at the Unity breakfast or Unity brunch, whatever it was this morning. Is that the case, Maura?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jim. I came from there just about 15 minutes ago, actually. These things tend to run a little longer.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to broach with you is after Deval Patrick was with us in the studio last Thursday, about an hour after he endorsed Warren Tolman in your race, and we broached the fact that it was surprising, not only that he endorsed in a contested primary with no incumbent, but doubly surprising because in many ways you are like him in terms of background, civil rights lawyer, all that sort of thing, coming from virtually nowhere, you issued a really tough statement about essentially the boys on Beacon Hill and the insiders and those sort of things. In all seriousness, are you concerned about any lingering impact on the sort of infrastructure of the Democratic Party vis-a-vis you because of what you said that day?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, this was a competitive race. It was a tough race. I think from the outset, I knew getting in that I was going to not have political establishment with me. And, you know, that was a message and a theme throughout this campaign. But look, you know, the voters went out yesterday and they cast their votes. And, you know, I think it was an energized win and showing for experience and somebody who's willing to fight and stand up for people in the state. So I'm proud of that victory. I look forward to working together with other Democrats and others in the party. We've got a lot of work to do in the weeks ahead, and we'll just continue to get after it every day like we've done these last 11 months.
You know, Maura Healey, you're a gay woman. Kerrigan, who just won the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor, is a gay guy. Seth Moulton, we just spoke to, who won his primary against John Tierney. He's a single guy. He's also a combat veteran from the Marines who singled out a black gay preacher in his victory speech. Is there some kind of generational thing going on? It seems like we're done with all this concern about who's gay, who's not, who's single, who's not. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'll leave it to others to assess, people who are far more expert in social studies and sociology than me. I'll tell you, it's exciting, though. You know, I mean, I think it's an exciting time. There are new generations of leaders emerging and folks who want to be involved in government. I think that's a great thing. I got to say, it was disappointing still with the turnout yesterday. We don't have enough people who are engaged in government and in politics. And, you know, I want to do everything I can to fight to fix that. But, you know, you know, new generations, we do bring new perspectives to things. You know, I'm just really proud of where our campaign ended up yesterday. You know, I know we got a lot of work ahead of us.
Well, thank you very much,
Maura
Healey, for being
with
us. Congratulations on your win last night. So let's get back to Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien here. Maura Healey, as I said, won a huge win over Warren Tolman. What happened?
She just ran a great campaign, and I think that she had the stronger argument for that particular office than Warren did. I like Warren. He's a friend. I supported him. I mean, I've talked to a lot of different women who high-profile women who've been in office, run for office, who supported Warren.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy. and had great union support, has run statewide. You know, this is his third time. But the fact is, I think people look at that race, and when she talked about, I want to be the people's lawyer, it made sense. And it just made more sense than Warren's argument. I mean, I think they both had great campaigns. They both ran great get-out-the-vote efforts. But I just think when you look at that office, it makes more sense.
Yeah. See, before you respond to that, but on the same note, I think that's a decent analysis until I look at the polls. They were in a dead heat. And then all of a sudden, she jumped to a 15-point lead in the Globe poll a week ago Friday. And it seemed to me the only major thing that happened in between to cause such a seismic shift was one word that crossed the lips of Warren Tolman at a debate at the Globe op-ed page with Joanna Weiss and Joan Vernocchi when she used the word unbecoming that had been used by Mitt Romney against you, Shannon O'Brien, in 2002. You, as a Tolman supporter, said the other day it's a non-issue because they're different people. Romney, you said, was not a supporter of women's issues, and Warren Tolman is. I think that had more impact because that poll also showed a huge surge in support from women voters for Maura Healey. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I you know, I'm not one to disagree with you, Jim, as you know.
Thank you kindly.
But I do think that this is just my gut. It just seems to me that it was more just a matter of people tuning in late to the race and starting to pay attention. And I just came away with two things. One was that having worked for a long time and recently in that office, she had a very she had a very detailed vision of what she wanted to do and what the office could do. And I think the second thing is what you just heard. I mean, she's just a very appealing, likable, smart person.
Can I tell you what the turning point was when you asked her to twirl the basketball on her finger?
Those who don't know, by the way, it was a great moment, and not by me, but by her. I'd never met her before. Yeah. This is a couple of months ago, and she was doing okay in the polls. I think it was before the convention. And I had seen these things, pro basketball player, she's 5'4", all this sort of thing. And so she talked in one of her videos about twirling the basketball on her finger, which is almost impossible to do. So I had a basketball with me under the counter at NECN, and two-thirds of the way through the interview, I threw her the ball. And I knew that there was no way in the world. She was either going to say, I really don't want to do this here, we're talking about the issues, in which case I would be embarrassed, or she would try it and not be able to do it, and she'd be embarrassed. She says, how long do you want me to do it for? And she just spins it on her finger. And the end of the interview, she's just spinning
I'm serious that she had a great there's a personality, and that's also one
charisma.
Of the issues.
She has charisma.
Yeah. And that ad with the basketball, 5'4" basketball player, you know what I mean? That's a great story. I mean, Tem for Treasurer was a ridiculous slogan that
got him elected. Tim Cahill.
And so I believe that she not only had, I think, the right messaging for this particular office in this campaign, but her ads were some of the best ads that were on TV. And by the way, they started airing just about the time, you know, that statement was made. So I really think that once she got on TV and people could sort of, those ads broke through the clutter, she's kind of cute throwing the basketball around. She was cute and serious.
Weren't you a star soccer player, Yale?
I was not a star.
How long could you keep a soccer ball in your foot without touching the ground?
I could do it about six times, and that was my max.
Can we get to say who's the Republican that's going to be running against Seth Moulton for John Tierney's seat for a second here, too? We just talked to Seth Moulton. He beat John Tierney last night. He's going to be running against Richard Tesei, another gay guy, actually, who's a Republican. We assume that Tesei would have rather run against John Tierney than Seth Moulton, but there is the argument that we don't have a single Republican in our delegation. So what's going to happen? How do you see Tesei Moulton shaping up?
Well, I think this is a lot harder for Richard Tesei than it would have been to run against Tierney. I mean, you know, Tierney is...
He lost to him last time by one point or something.
By the way, up until very late that evening, they thought Tesei was going to beat
him.
Right.
No, I mean, and, you know, Tierney is sort of made to measure, you know, exactly who somebody like Richard wants to face. You know, Moulton is much tougher because you certainly can make the all-Democratic argument. But, you know, then again, so can people in eight other races. And it doesn't seem to do a whole lot of good.
Yeah, but I know I am Johnny One Note, and I know people are sick of this, particularly you, Shannon O'Brien. I think in a state with one party rule that just for so long on 11 out of 11 congressional offices, 2 Senate, 9 Congress people, all the constitutional officers, Democrats, the thing we discussed with Charlie Baker, they discussed with you ad nauseum, Shannon, about the Gang of Three thing, to say, I'm assuming, saying during the campaign, wait a second, John Boehner and the Republicans are the majority. You don't want one congressperson from Massachusetts to sit in that caucus? Shannon, those are both pretty powerful arguments, particularly since Baker and Tesei are not scary right-wing nuts. They're moderate Republicans,
right? I think they're two completely different arguments. I think that people here in Massachusetts don't want one more person voting and giving Boehner any more power down in Washington. I think that that's why people continue to vote for Democratic congressmen. You know, even when John Tierney was very weak 2 years ago, they still voted for him. And I think it had more to do with Boehner than it had to do with John, with Richard Tesei.
Well, it may have had something to do with Barack Obama.
Well,
being
that,
on
that
the
also,
ticket
that
too.
Also. But I think that it's hard. And again, now that you come to this, I think the Gang of Three argument, I think that what Charlie Baker is talking about is bipartisan. And he's going to, he will be the one candidate in this race. And we talked about this, I think, the last time we were here, going after the Patrick administration and going after, you know, some of the issues that they've had. I think that's a much stronger argument here within state government as opposed to federal government. I think they're two different.
That brings up, I think, what is a huge, huge, huge issue in the state race that no one has talked about
What's
yet.
That?
And that is simply that it's this question. Will the state Democratic Party, Tammany Hall, be as strong under – can it do the things under – Senator McGee, Tom McGee, the new state
party chair,
that it could do under Boss Walsh, who was unbelievable.
John Walsh, one of the most skillful political organizers.
And are they going to be able to you know run sock puppets and have them win, which was the case under Walsh? And you know, I think that's a big. It's an insider thing, but it's a big question that is yet to be answered.
You know, I think the Globe had a story the other day saying that a lot of the Grossman voters were going to go to Charlie Baker.
48-28.
Okay, we're getting an email right here from one of them, from Jim, who says, I'm a Democrat. I voted for Steve Grossman, but I'll be voting for Charlie Baker. I lack confidence in Martha's ability to be the leader of my state. Not inspiring. Her biggest accomplishment is being able to climb to the top of the Democratic political pile. Also, we need a non-Democratic leader to balance the Democratic legislature. So there's exactly what you've been talking about, Jim, and that's exactly what the Globe story said. Some of the Grossman voters defecting.
Which is why I think she has to do a better job of enunciating how she hasn't been part of that so-called, you know, old boys network. But don't say that because I can't stand when people say old boys network. It was hard for me coming from the legislature, even though I had great support from many of the people, you know, it was when, you know, Tom Finneran was speaker. All of this sort of anti-Finneran, the people who were kind of, you know, railing against former speaker Tom Finneran, they all supported me because they understood that I would be independent and both work with collaboratively but also independently. Didn't make a difference when I ran for governor. She has to figure out how to crystallize that argument, how she's different and how she can separate herself from the legislature. She's got to do it quickly.
One last thing about advice for candidates. It seems to me that Charlie Baker, Charlie Chipio, has a fairly fine line that he's got to draw. Some of the management things that have fallen apart under Deval Patrick in the last year are things which, in my sense, is both anecdotally and polls, do concern the public, from medical marijuana to that compounding thing to DCF.
But he
However,
remains very popular.
He is wildly popular. Yep. Mm-hmm. So you're Charlie Baker. How do you not alienate people who have great respect for Deval Patrick and see him approvingly, particularly since I assume he's going to campaign.
Yeah,
I don't know
I was
this for
say, that,
Martha Coakley a lot and criticize the
that
content.
That is absolutely, I think, a very – you're absolutely right. That is a key issue. And you saw it last night because – you know, Patrick just let loose after years or months of, you know, holding his tongue, you know, for being criticized, you know, for actually having made a mistake. He was wild last night. And you know that he's going to, you know, he takes this all very personally and he's going to be, you know, and I think that if you're Baker, you probably want to be careful because Patrick is very effective at striking back.
So and
how
this
do you
is
do
and
that?
This is his legacy.
Yes.
He's walking out of here and whether
this,
or not anyone believes
this is his opportunity
that
Deval
Patrick
national.
Would like to run for some national office at some point in
and
time.
He would.
He has to guard his reputation here in Massachusetts.
Hey, before you go, 30 seconds, Shannon O'Brien, how hard is it watching things like last night? I know you're doing commentary at NECN. You came very close to being the first woman governor in a state that has never had a woman governor. What is
elected.
It? 12 years
elected.
Later, elected. I'm sorry. Obviously, Jane Swift moved up to the position when when Paul Cellucci left for Canada. How hard is it for you 12 years after to watch this stuff? Is it, or you're...
I don't sob openly anymore, Jim. It's okay.
No, I'm serious. Jim,
you know, and the thing is politics. You know, I ran against Mitt Romney, who was a pro-choice, pro-woman, pro-this, you know, and that's not who he was. And so, you know, I kind of look back and I go, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, but it, that's life. You know what I mean? And I love politics. I love public service. And, you know, it's why I still go out and knock on doors like every other, you know, average political activist, because I think it's very important to get people involved, because I think that who leads is very important in this state and in this country.
Great to see you both.
Thanks. Thank you for coming in. Shannon O'Brien is a former state treasurer and gubernatorial Democratic nominee. I think we said that several times. John Chipio runs Chipio Strategies. He was also a policy advisor in the Romney administration. Coming up, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us. What do Ebola and the Kardashians have in common? He'll make that connection next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Is Ebola the Kardashian of diseases? One doctor says it is, and that it's stealing the spotlight from some of Africa's doubtier, but just as deadly, if not more deadly, diseases. And new research finds that we have the need to feed when we watch thrillers and action-adventure movies. Could this give us new insight into how we eat when we're under duress? Or will theaters use this research, which they will, to push towering tubs of butter-covered popcorn? Joining us for his take on these and other medical headlines is bioethicist Art Kaplan. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Hey, thank you for joining us today, Art. So let's start with Joan Rivers, the famous comedian who died a few days ago. She was treated for some throat ailment we don't know about at a clinic in Manhattan, and there's an investigation into that clinic. I want to just read a bit from this morning's New York Times talking about this clinic. It's called Yorkville Endoscopy. It's a for-profit center. It's drawn attention to this apparently flourishing model of outpatient surgery centers licensed by the state to replace hospital operating rooms for minor procedures. The management structure is designed to maximize profits for doctors. They're apparently common in other states and now gaining traction in New York. I'm wondering, particularly because they had to call the EMTs when she went into cardiac arrest, is there something to worry about with these clinics, Art Kaplan?
Well, let me begin by saying I'm about to comment on the clinic and Joan Rivers completely in the absence of knowing any facts about what happened to her. That hasn't stopped anybody else from commenting, so yeah. I will now join in. But the generic question is, what about the clinics?
Yeah.
And, you know, 60%, 60, of surgeries are done in this kind of clinic in the U.S. I think the Times gives you the impression that this is some kind of new and growing phenomena. Think about where you go to get your colonoscopy. Well, don't think about your colonoscopy, but if you were getting one, you would be in an outpatient center, right?
Right.
And if you were getting an arthroscopy of your knee because you might have torn something and tripped or had an injury playing a sport, you're in an outpatient clinic. People are looking into you and peering into you and all your parts in outpatient settings. Millions and millions and millions of procedures are done each year in these settings. So the problem with them isn't that they're new and increasing. It's that they are everywhere, and they are cheaper, and that's why payers, including the government, like them. They cost less. One of the reasons they cost less is they don't have all the apparatus and rigmarole that a hospital does. They don't have an anesthesiologist necessarily hanging around. They don't necessarily have all the same resuscitation equipment. That's why they're cheaper. So the question isn't so much how did that clinic do where Joan Rivers had her procedure. Question is, are we regulating outpatient surgery sufficiently? And I'm going to answer that no. I think it's an area where you have a lot of doctor-owned, doctor-run, doctor-invested operations. The regulations for certification and oversight aren't great. Hospitals get accredited in a fairly tight way. And so the answer to Marjorie's question is, you know, do they have the right backup? Do they have the right equipment in case somebody had an arrest? How many minutes could you be from an EMT if you had a procedure done in rural Massachusetts at an outpatient clinic? I think all that stuff needs to be looked at, not because I know that anything went wrong or was inadequate in Joan Rivers' case, but it's just it's an occasion to ask the question.
Well, I just want to be clear on this, because I would assume one of the things that startled me in this Times piece this morning was that they needed the EMTs. I would presume, and maybe I'm incorrect, but if I went into cardiac arrest at the Brigham and Women's or Beth Israel Hospital, they wouldn't need to call the Boston Fire Department. The people at the Brigham or the Beth BI would be able to intubate me or take care of me. That was what seemed so weird about this.
True, and you would have that backup if you were there. On the other hand, people say, well, if there's a clinic and the doctors know how to get a tube into your airway and they know CPR and they have a defibrillator and they can call an ambulance that can be there in less than 5 minutes, that's good enough. Or is it? And what I mean by that is we haven't had that discussion or debate. I don't think we have the kind of standards about resuscitation, training, availability of equipment. Obviously, an outpatient center is never going to be a hospital. And people think, well, then I don't want to go anywhere except in a hospital to get these procedures done. You're going to be paying a whopping big copay if you do that. If you get your colonoscopy at some large hospital, it's going to be way, 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 way more expensive.
Yeah, but Art, and not only is it more expensive, but these are also much more convenient, not just cheaper, but much more convenient geographically in most cases. One last question about this as well. As an outsider, I agree with you on the under-regulation. Let me play ethicist for a minute. It seems to me that these places, since most of us are used to not going to these kinds of places, that they have an obligation for new users to explain not only what they do, but what they don't do and what they don't have, so you can make an informed choice if that's the right location for your procedure. Is that not a reasonable position?
That is so dreamy, idealistic, and optimistic that I would issue you an ethics card on the spot.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. You know, informed consent, you're supposed to get the risks and the benefits all the way through when you own it, when you make the money from it, when it's your place. I just wonder how zealous you will be on the risk side in the explanation.
Okay, we're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Let's move on to something I thought was kind of a riot, that if you're watching action films, you're going to eat more. This group at Cornell had people watch some clip from The Island. I guess it was this big action movie in 2005. The second group watched part of a Charlie Rose interview on PBS. The third group watched the same excerpt from the action film, but without the sound. The first group consumes 65% more calories, the action film people, than the Charlie Rose group, and 98% more food, 98% more food, and they even ate more food and consumed more calories watching The Island on mute and didn't eat much watching Charlie Rose. So what do we make of this, Art?
It's impossible to eat if you're over 65 and asleep.
Oh, no. We love Charlie Rose.
Are you surprised by this? I am so unsurprised.
I am so unsurprised. I'm with you. This is like, and who paid for this study exactly?
Yeah, Cornell, I guess.
The Popcorn Association of America, I believe it was, yes.
But no, I'm not surprised. So clearly, watch an action movie. I'm tempted to try and figure out what would happen if it was pornography, but let's just stick with the action movie, and you get excited, and you're paying attention, and you're alert, and you're all these hormones and stimuli are going because you're identifying with the action sequences, and you get nervous, and you want to eat. I think one response of many, not all, but many people, when they get into a kind of tension situation, is to look for something to eat. So, no, I'm not surprised. And I like Charlie Rose, too, but I don't think of him as exactly
action-packed.
But, you know, while we're both making light of this, and I guess Marjorie is, too, there is a message here in terms of, not that we didn't know this something like this before. If you're concerned about weight, and we've talked about this repeatedly with you, Art, there are certain behaviors that are more conducive to either staying fit or getting fit than other behaviors. And I'm not suggesting people stop watching action films, but there is a message to the madness, no?
Yeah, there is. Absolutely fair. And I think one of the questions is, if we know that a 10-gallon bucket of butter substitute popcorn contains enough calories to take you through 2 weeks of survivalism. Is that going to really be what we allow to be sold to kids? I'm willing to say good for adults, but it gets us to build up soda restrictions and other, you know, sometimes when you think, oh, gosh, you don't want the kids eating that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to quite get to the nanny state, but that one makes me think. The right kind of movie, action movie, kids getting there, adolescents getting there, huge caloric intake available right down the hall or before they go in. I don't like saying the state is going to control your popcorn, but when it comes to kids, it does make me think.
But let me just say quickly about this, because I'm always looking at both sides of the issue, unlike you, Art, of course, is that, yes, while the popcorn containers are far too caloric and far too large, once you're done, you can bathe in them. So that's a...
That is true.
Okay, so, I mean, try to look at both sides if you're going to be fair. We're talking Art Kaplan, medical ethicist at NYU.
So the DEA now wants to allow that's the Drug Enforcement Administration, I should say, wants people to be able to return their unused pills, like opiate painkillers, to pharmacies because they're worried about them being pilfered, among other people, by teenagers if they're grown-ups with those pills in their house. What do you think of this idea, Art?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's going to have about the same impact as those bring back your gun days,
yeah,
where somebody brings in the antique Civil War weapon that couldn't function anyway. Look, people are busy. I don't think they're going to be running down to the pharmacy to bring back their unused prescriptions. And even some bad guys are going to be thinking, I could sell these. Why would I give them back to the pharmacy? Some bad folks will be thinking that way. So I'm not optimistic. I mean, it's fine. Good. Promote it. I'd be more excited if we could get the industry, pharmaceutical industry, to say, hey, let's make sure that the only kind of medicine cabinet that's sold is one that locks. I think locking your medicine cabinet is a very good thing to do because just people don't get into it. You know, I heard, this is incredible. I was talking to a real estate agent the other day at a party, and she told me that they have to be careful when people come in and tour houses that they don't steal drugs.
Oh, my God.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
You know what I've often wondered, too, Art? If you go, like, to say to, you know, have your wisdom teeth out or something, you know, that you want to get painkillers because you're worried about the pain, but you always get this huge bottle of them. And many people find that they don't need them or they don't like the way the painkillers make them feel. So after you've taken, like, one or two, you say, the heck with it. Why don't they just give you four pills? And if you need some more, you go back and get them or you send your spouse off to get them.
Yeah, I think it's partly profit. And so people are saying, I want to, you know, the minimum unit I'm going to let you buy is 30 of these. And I agree with you, Marjorie. I think that's really, in a climate when we have mistakes with pills, just people accidentally overdosing or suiciding or having their kids steal the drugs, or for all I know, the people looking at your house rattling through your medicine chest, we ought to go right down the road you're talking about. So let's sell minimal prescriptions. Let's lock up the medicine cabinets. And, you know, bringing them back, that's fine, too. But we've got to do more. This prescription drug abuse problem is really out of control.
You know, well, there's a doctor that's quoted the New York Times story from Tufts who says, and he agrees with you, it's like trying to eliminate malaria in Africa by killing a dozen mosquitoes. But it's not nothing, as the saying goes. And I agree with you. Much more needs to be done. I love the idea of locking your medicine cabinets. But were you aware, when I read this New York Times story, I was unaware of this, that under the DEA, two times a year, I guess nationally, people could anonymously return to police department their drugs. Apparently, this has taken 4 million pounds of prescription medications off the street or out of your cabinets over 4 years, which, again, is not that much when there are 4 billion prescriptions filled just last year, 3.9 billion. Were you aware of this national give-back, take-back program that already exists?
I've never heard of it. Nope.
Nor did I.
Yeah, neither did I.
And you know, that's another big issue. So you want to make sure, it's great to have a program, but you really got to promote it, advertise it, make people aware of it. I get nervous when I hear that none of us knew about it. You start to wonder, you know, is this the 3 a.m. public service ad community that's aware of it. I was not.
Hey, one last thing about this is Marjorie said to me this morning when we were talking about this in anticipation of talking to you, she said, what do you do with drugs that you don't use? And I said, I flush them down the toilet. And she said, why do you flush them down the toilet rather than just throwing them out? I don't know what the answer is. I don't know why I do it. But since I do it, and since I know lots of people who do,
it's bad.
Is there an environmental impact of thousands, if not millions of people throwing prescription drugs down toilets?
Yes, there is. And a lot of studies have been done to see what the level is of different drugs, including birth control, hormones, and other things rattling around in water supplies. It depends on the water supply, but you can get some at least nervous-making concentrations of drugs in many communities. So I still think it's better to burn them up in the incinerator than it is to flush them down the drain.
Talking to Art Kaplan from NYU.
I just put them in the trash and threw them out. Maybe people are rifling through my trash bags, too. I don't know.
Just don't sell your house anytime
soon.
Drug
supply I have. My wisdom teeth pills. Anyway, let's move on to Ebola. There was a great piece written talking about how the Ebola is stealing attention from illnesses that kill many more people, like malaria and diarrhea and even the H1N1 swine flu pandemic. People are panicked about Ebola, though.
Absolutely, 100% freaked out. World Health Organization says it's an epidemic that's raging out of control in Africa. U.S. officials at the NIH and CDC use the same language. They don't use that language when it comes to malaria. They haven't used that language when it comes to cholera, diuretic diseases in children. So I think an infectious, deadly, contagious disease does freak us out because we worry, ooh, that's coming here, which most likely malaria and cholera are not. So that's just self-interest reflected in the sort of attention that Ebola gets. Ebola also has the wondrous photogenicity of moon suits and goggles. And, you know, there's some really cool pictures there, whereas I think we could all imagine cholera not being quite as lending itself to the same imagery that we all want to look at. So, yeah, Ebola is probably blowing things out of proportion budget-wise, but it's almost psychologically, not ethically, but psychologically, you could almost understand.
You can, and I understand that none of us are showing a lack of sympathy, and we've talked a lot about it here, but I'm just reading these numbers as you're speaking. So it's several thousand people, a couple thousand people so far have died of Ebola in West Africa. Diarrhea, obviously preventable and treatable, kills 1.5 million kids every single year. I mean, it seems to me, not that I'm giving you advice, particularly since you didn't ask for it, if there was ever an ethical issue, isn't this one about prioritizing what is having the most damaging impact on human lives around the planet?
I think there is a responsibility to call attention to the fact that while this is an exotic and scary and almost made for Hollywood kind of disease, it isn't the major problem for public health in poor African nations. It just isn't. I'm not saying we don't do anything about it, but it's not. And by the way, the same issue comes up for our good friend, the Ice Bucket Challenge in
yes.
ALS.
Yeah. Yes.
ALS isn't the world's, America's biggest killer by far. I mean, it's a small number of people that get a terrible, terrible disease. And I've heard a lot of the fundraising groups complaining in the background that, you know, cancer, heart disease, Parkinsonism, diabetes, we've got a bunch of other killers out there, and they didn't have a gimmick.
Yeah, but I would distinguish that. That gimmick, as you call it, I assume you don't mean that. I don't know if you mean it in a pejorative way. It is a gimmick, but people are voluntarily. There's a private effort. People are voluntarily choosing to participate. Here is an intergovernmental agency decision to declare Ebola whatever it's being declared and to downgrade comparatively speaking. So to me, at least, that's much more of an egregious problem than is the disproportionate percentage of donations that's going to ALS as a result of Pete Frates and the Ice Bucket Challenge. Don't you think?
Yeah, I do, and I think you're grinding your way toward advanced bioethics degrees at this point because you're right. Government policy is not the same as private altruism, and there are plenty of things that privately, altruistically, people donate to or give to that, you know, they donate their fortune to their rescue of pets and all kinds of things that you could argue, well, what about humans, and we don't stop them. We could have a little ethics argument about the best way to use your money to help relieve suffering and so forth in the world. But government policy, International Healthcare Organization policy, you're absolutely right. There they have a responsibility to sort of say, look, we want to fight Ebola, and it is important, but we do have these other things in the background that are killing millions, and we still have to keep our eye on that ball.
So if we were to ask you, with no preparation on your part, what are you talking about on the Everyday Ethics podcast this week, would you draw a blank?
No. You know what we're talking about this week?
What's that?
We're giving a little look-see to Ray Rice and domestic violence.
Oh, great.
Fantastic.
And my, I'll just tell you, my take on this is I'm not that interested in firing the commissioner or, you know, whether the penalty initially was too weak, although clearly it was too weak. I'm partly interested in why it was that people didn't care until they saw Ray Rice knock this woman out on a video. He dragged her out in an earlier video from an elevator, and that would seem to me to give us all we needed to know. And I said so then about, you know, what he had done. The other thing is, it turns out there's no good numbers on whether athletes, pro athletes, have a higher rate of domestic violence. Are they more at risk? And I just ask that because they're the trendsetters and, to some extent, the role model. So does the NFL or pro sports have a bigger problem with this, smaller problem? But I think that's something we might ask them to study.
Well, it's also something we might ask you about next week, too, because it can continue to play out. Thank you, Art. We really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and co-host of what Jim just mentioned, Everyday Ethics Podcast. And as always, it's great to talk to Art Kaplan. Up next, Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us for Open Mic. We'll get her take on President Obama's speech tonight on his plans to disable ISIS. Will this mean Mission Impossible? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. 2 weeks ago, President Obama did not have a clear strategy on how to deal with ISIS. He admitted it. Since then, he's pulled one together, which he'll discuss tonight at 9 p.m. In a statement, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the president will lay out a plan for, quote, degrading and ultimately destroying the terrorist group. Is this the right tactic? Or are these the words that ISIS has been waiting to hear? Join us to go over what the president should do and what he will do is Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem. She joins us every Wednesday. Hello there, Juliette.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Hello, Juliette. Well, the speech is going to be tonight. We're going to be broadcasting it live here at WGBH. What do you think he's going to say and what should he be saying? And I'm scared this is Mission Impossible.
Well, it might be, but kudos, I think, at this stage to the president for not jumping when everyone said jump. We have been talking about his strategy for 3 weeks, and I kept saying, what's so wrong with waiting for a strategy? For one, then we're going to know we're going to have gathered some intelligence. And secondly, clearly he's going to announce some coalition of the willing or unwilling, depending on who's forming. I'm reading what you're reading, and certainly you're starting to hear the rumors of it that there'll be some military action in Syria. And one can assume that that might be with a wink and a nod by President Assad, who views ISIS as a problematic as well. So this is serious. And so he's going to address the nation and, I think, determine how much authority he needs from Congress. Jim, I know that's your favorite subject.
Well, it's pretty important.
It is. I mean, I think
his position so far seems to be, I don't need, I'll confer, but I do not need an authorization. And a lot of Democrats and Republicans think he does, including Seth Moulton, with whom we just spoke, who's running for Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, even politically, given the amount of support there seems to be for military action, if it's well-defined and we know what it is and it's not troops on the ground, you should go after it. I mean, because you have Congress's back, make them vote. All this talk by the right and the left about we have to be tougher, or not the left, but the right, you know, make them vote.
But beyond the politics of it, I think a lot of us are very concerned about the feasibility of it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to go over and we're going to bomb these people. A lot of them are hiding with civilians and they're,
right.
I mean, how do you do that?
Right. I mean, well, that's what I think the delay has been about. So we've only been talking about the military mission. There's obviously been covert intelligence, all sorts of other missions going on in the area. Second, the bombings in Iraq appear to be somewhat successful. I mean, in terms of dispersing, which is not a bad thing to do, ISIS, right? You're not going to just totally destroy them. You're not, you know, they're not going to go away overnight. But the more, the longer you make it difficult for them to unify, plan, and also govern. Remember, they're, you know, they, you know, any terrorist organization who then has to pick up the trash finds themselves less popular than they once were, right? Yeah. As we know. You as know, every Boston mayor knows.
It seems to me that part of the president's mission, he's got to walk a fine line on a variety of things tonight, is to make the American people nervous enough that their war-weary selves are willing to back this without going too far. We were talking to your former colleague at CNN, John King, yesterday. Just had a new poll. 70% of Americans think ISIS is a threat directly to the United States. And the only way I could – Marjorie and I talked a lot about it. The only – rationale I could think that would cause that number to be so high is when people like that UMass guy from Stoughton, a local guy who's allegedly in the communications arm now of ISIS, the people from Minnesota, when we hear that in a visceral way, it makes us nervous. Why is that number so high?
I was surprised at it too. I mean, because the number, remember, Jim, compares it to like September 12th, 2001. So after Al-Qaeda had killed 3,000 people in the United States, ISIS has had no successful attack against essentially Western interests, except the, not that I don't mean this, you know, to negate it, but the intentional killing of hostages. So their success has less to do with their capacity and more to do with their media. They are
the videos of the beheadings, for example,
and the imagery and the, you know, we're going to push it out. They're not passive about media. They are pushing out their messaging, pushing out their horror. It is horrible, and they are doing it in a way that's very accessible to the West. So it's not like some super squirrely group of Al Qaeda hiding in Afghanistan. I mean, you just type in ISIS on Twitter and enough time, and you'll find stuff that you just don't want to see. And so part of it is just their success, and I think the challenge for the United States, and certainly the challenge for the president, is if ISIS says jump, we don't have to say how high. Do not let them set the timetable based on their media strategy.
Well, speaking of media strategy, it scares me to think that, okay, we were talking yesterday also with the filmmaker who made this piece about Boko Haram, the terrible terrorist groups running around Nigeria. Now, if Boko Haram were to capture two Americans and execute them and put it on YouTube, are we not going to go attack Boko Haram? I mean, you're afraid that this is all about reaction to, as horrible as those deaths were, that it's a media driven response.
Exactly. And all the calls for the president to do more without anyone being specific about what the more was or the necessity of having a coalition where people being driven or, in fact, manipulating these horrible deaths to get some policy or to get some criticism out of the president. We are the United States. ISIS is not an existential threat. It is a threat. We are the strongest nation in the world. Once again, they say jump. We don't have to say how high.
You know, Juliet, for the last couple of weeks, you've been praising the president for his caution and his unwillingness to just jump in with a strategy before he's ready. You've heard, I don't know if you've heard us say, Marjorie and I, our favorite satirist by far is Andy Borowitz, the great blogger. Borowitz did a thing the other day. Remember when Obama said that on his bucket list was going to Stonehenge? He goes to Stonehenge, and the headline is something like, McCain trashes Obama for failure to bomb Stonehenge. Which is, in any case, let's stay on this thing for one more second. Okay. You were on CNN the other day, and you were quoted talking about the guy I mentioned a minute ago, this guy Ahmad Abu Samra, is that how you pronounce his last name? Yeah. Here's what you said. At some stage, we have to accept reality, which is a number of people who have taken up arms against Americans, either here in Boston or abroad with ISIS, have an affiliation with that mosque. That's what the mosque, the Islamic Society of Boston, which is it's called the Cambridge Mosque, colloquially.
Near where we
block
live.
From where we are. I live and pretty close to where you live.
We live close to each other,
And so the mosque will come under scrutiny to determine what is going on and whether as importantly, there aren't others affiliated with the mosque who might be planning ill will. Not only did this guy attend, but the older Tsarnaev, before he was kicked out, attended. I was surprised to hear you say that. What's the rationale?
Well, I'm going to put that quote in context. There are too many data points with this mosque to think that it should, I mean, we should be determining what's going on at the mosque. There's just no question about it. There's just, there's not that many terrorists in the United States that 6 or 7 or 8 of them happen to have been praying there.
When you say find out, I'm sorry to interrupt, do we infiltrate it? What do we do?
No, I mean, I think I said it, there's many ways to get more investigations. And I actually think it would be negligence not to do so. In the same way that a church, as you certainly know, can't hide from a sexual abuse scandal by saying we're a church. I am not saying, however, that the leadership of the mosque is responsible, that there's some fiery imam that's radicalizing people. I think, and I am sure this is going on, that there is a lot of cooperation between the mosque and the FBI now about who has been there. Who did they talk to? Is there more information we can get? Where is he? Where is he? That's the most important thing. And so investigations aren't always FBI walks in with their guns blazing, although sometimes it is. But it is also can be that cooperative effort, which I think is actually the most successful. But I think it's very important that people not – I think it's important that we're not focused on the mosque as definite as the place where bad things are happening. It is – you know, Jim, as you know, on Prospect Street, it is 2 blocks from the Red Line. It is a vibrant place. We want that. We nurture it in our community and the diversity of Cambridge. And so, but on the other hand, you know, you can't turn a blind eye to it.
That is Julia Kayyem. She is a former Homeland Security official for both the Obama administration and the Deval Patrick administration.
But that gets everyone's hackles up. You realize that notion of going into a mosque, even surreptitiously undercover, and trying to find out, because you're going to be questioning the FBI, whoever it is, would be questioning the people there about their parishioners, for lack of a better,
I'm not saying that they're infiltrating. The first step in an investigation is, what proof do we have that anything bad is going on at the mosque? That anything being led by leadership of the mosque has led to the radicalization. We have the exact opposite evidence, which is they kicked the elder Sinaref out when he became sort of, you know, radicalized and fiery. Reaching out to the mosque to see what we can get from them, what they might know, and they might not know that they actually know something, and who are the friends of a man who is in senior leadership of ISIS. But I mean, I am, you know, I when I worked for Governor Patrick, I was part of an effort for outreach to mosque. I am Arab American. I am more sensitive than most to these issues. And I think the greatest form of sensitivity is to respect the mosque and say, we don't think that you are doing anything fiery or illegal. Help us help America. Okay. And most Muslims are on board with that.
If we can just switch for a second. Yeah. I heard from one of our producers, is it true you took a she taxi here to the studio today?
I know. Don't you love that idea?
What is that, Marjorie?
It's this new taxi service. It just started. Well, actually, it hasn't started yet. It starts September 16th in New York City and a bunch of other areas around there, which offers female drivers exclusively. It's going to be available through an app. It's called She Taxi. And apparently, the drivers show up sporting hot pink pashmina scarves.
Oh, wait a second. And only four female
passengers.
So it's sort of Homeland Security to personal
security. Yeah, it's like safety and security. Right. It's a security for women by women. I love it. And it is – no, it is – it is creative. I love the pashmina part, because my whole theory of dressing in the kind of jobs I have been is that you always travel with a purple and a black pashmina. Anything you make a dress dressier, you make jeans dressier, you make something less dressy. So I love that they've taken on my theory of travel, which is 2 pashminas and black pants.
Well, you know what else I love about it? This one of the people in the story talked about how she loved to send it, made her feel better about sending her daughters.
Yes,
because you know, I mean, taxi drivers, the most part, right, they're wonderful people, but given a choice between a man taxi driver carting my kids around, female kids around, I go with the woman driver.
And at a certain
time
of night, or if you have found yourself in a compromising position, or you drank too much and you just don't want to get into your car, absolutely. And so I think it's just I think it's a great idea.
But you're a big time lawyer in addition to everything else you do, Julia.
I haven't practiced law.
Well, whatever.
Okay,
sort of a big
ask
time
me for
lawyer.
Yeah. Ask me for my legal advice.
Is there
now
a legal issue here? I mean, by the way, as the father of 2 daughters, I love this idea too.
Yeah,
but so a guy goes on the app for She Taxis and say, could you pick me up at 1 Guest Street at WGBH? And they say, I'm sorry, John, we can't pick you up. We don't pick up men.
Right.
Is that a problem?
I'm not sure if it would violate sort of public accommodation rules, but some guy has to bring the challenge. And it's not even sure, you know, and so I dare that guy to do it.
By the way, it's, you know, in all seriousness, also, for considering the security, personal security issue is a huge one in 2014. This is a really creative.
It is.
Partial solution to a real serious issue.
What do you think the reason is only 5% of the taxi drivers in New York are women? Because I think a lot of women view this as a scary job.
Yeah.
They want to pick up three guys at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So it gives an opportunity for women to become taxi drivers that might not otherwise
have
that.
Right. And I love the creativity with something scary like Homeland Security, because I think that that is one of the ways Homeland Security has failed the American public is we make it so scary and bombs and guns and everything else. And actually, it's that kind of practical intimacy that makes us more safe than almost anything else that you can do.
I couldn't agree more.
Do we have time for the VA?
A couple of minutes. Yeah, sure.
Well, let's talk really quickly about the new guy, Robert McDonald.
Yes, McDonald.
His 90-day plan for fixing the VA gave reporters his cell phone. I mean, 90 days seems to be crazy to me to fix anything in that short a period of time.
Yeah, well, it depends on how he's I read that as how he's measuring the fixes. They were pretty far enough along under Shinseki. You know, he was fixing a lot of the computers. But it's you look, at some stage, we talked about this last week, Shinseki, the former secretary, was surrounded by too much criticism that he could not effectuate change. And so I think part of this is just really important for the kinds of fixes, which include mostly computer filing and getting people off those waiting lists.
And by the way, if you have a problem, Marjorie said he gave it to reporters. He also gave it to reporters to give it to the public. If you want to speak to Robert McDonald, who's the new secretary of the VA, the cell phone number, and apparently he picks it up when he's available, is 513.
Are we calling it?
We should have, actually. 513. Can someone call
right
now?
Wait, you know what? We should 513. Call him and then link in Steve Grossman's mom, because he disclosed her phone number at one of the debates, and so I think that'd be great.
Here's a number, 513-509-8454. Our producers are calling and we'll let you know if we get McDonald. If we get McDonald on the phone, we'll bring him on for a couple of seconds. Hey, before you go, in your former life, not so former ago, you were a Democratic candidate for governor. I'm assuming that you went to this Unity breakfast.
Yes, I did.
So
Unity.
That is where the people who hated their opponents until 8:15 last night say that they're going to be the greatest leaders in the history of the Western world. The one I'm most interested in, and I thought he gave a brilliant and gracious speech last night, was Steve Grossman. Yeah. Steve Grossman, we've talked about it ad nauseum, and the most recent poll says that 48% of his supporters, if he doesn't win the primary, which he didn't, say they will support Charlie Baker, and only 28 will support Martha Coakley. So his support is important. What was that like this morning?
Oh, it was. I mean, it was actually a lovely event. Can I just say?
Excuse me, 1 second. We got voicemail for Secretary McDonald. We'll keep trying.
Okay. I'd like to say something about Steve Grossman because he ran an incredible campaign. He is was energetic. He used to. You know, how old is he?
68.
I mean, I'm 45. He would go to 10 more events than me. I was exhausted. But he really cares. And I just, as someone who came into the race not knowing anything, he is just a very good person. And that was reflected in the speech, not just last night, but this morning. If you are a Steve Grossman supporter and you have any doubts about where his heart is, you have no doubts. Listen to that speech. He is with Martha Coakley and said he will work to support her. And I believe him.
You know Baker and are you friendly with Baker?
I've talked to Baker a couple times and I've met him and I roasted him once in one of the St. Patrick's events. Charlie Baker called me after I didn't make the ballot.
Did he really?
Yeah. And he talked to me about losing and what to learn and, you know, the process that he went through. Every candidate who loses, I heard you talking to Shannon O'Brien. I mean, you just have to go through the process of sort of what does that mean and everything else. But, you know, I've been out of the race for 3 months. So the Unity event was actually an opportunity to see a lot of friends and support the ballot, because what Deval Patrick made clear is this is going to be hard.
It is going to be hard.
Yeah. We only have 30 seconds left. Before we go away, speaking of hard, Michael Dukakis, who knows a little bit about winning and losing governor's races, said, quote, "I am very concerned about Charlie Baker." The Democrats should be, should they not?
I think they should only because of our history and because we have to make it clear that we can take nothing for granted. I don't think that's something against Martha Coakley. We need the fire in our belly because this is going to be a fight, and it's going to be a fight across the nation.
By the way, you got to go because your sheet tax is waiting for you out.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Juliet, thank
it's
you,
great to see
for
you Juliet.
Coming in.
Bye,
Juliet
you guys.
Kayhem,
see you next week.
Is a Homeland Security expert. She's worked in both Deval Patrick's and Barack Obama's administration. She joins us every Wednesday. Tonight at 9 o'clock, WGBH will be carrying the president's address live on ISIS. Coming up, earlier this morning, we spoke with Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory about the elections and a bunch of other things. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us as he does every Wednesday on the line is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGrory. Hello there, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
Great. Hi, great to talk to you, Brian McGrory. So, you know, we didn't have actually a mob scene at the polls yesterday, but it was primary day yesterday. Some surprises. What was your takeaway, Brian McGrory?
Oh, I thought it was an exciting day. I mean, yes, let's accept that there wasn't a particularly high turnout. Actually, there's a pretty low turnout, but the voters who did turn out looked like they had a restless nature to them. They almost on the Democratic side, declined to put Martha Coakley in as their nominee. It was a far tighter margin than we could have expected. They turned out a nine-term congressman, John Tierney. They brought in a newcomer, Maura Healey, is a nominee for attorney general. I thought it was a pretty exciting day overall, on a day that easily could have been a snooze.
You know, I know you're not in charge of the editorial page, but I'm going to make this case anyway. You should call the editor of the editorial page if you want my opinion, which you haven't asked for, and say you should do a lead editorial saying for the 80% or whomever who chose to sit on their hands when there are all these open offices that matter, you should shut up and not complain about anything. Are you not, I agree there was a restless nature. Are you not troubled by this pathetic, pitiful turnout yesterday, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, of course. But, you know, look, at the reality, Jim, and it's a much deeper conversation than we probably have time for here. It's in the government's hands to change this. We could do a whole lot of different things in terms of voting. And elected office holders are deciding not to do it. We could have easier registration. We could actually go to the extreme and have internet voting. There are many, many other things we could do to encourage a higher turnout than the way we do it right now.
Brian, when you say
we're still voting the same way now we did in the 1800s. It's a different kind of life we lead here, and I think that's worth a much deeper exploration.
Well, lots of people talk about doing online voting and how attractive that would be, especially to younger people. But Brian McGraw, when you say restless nature, do you mean sort of a throw-the-bums-out kind of idea because people are fed up with the government and Congress and even locally, their local elected officials?
I mean, I don't know if it's quite that clear, if the line is quite that straight. But, you know, clearly, Marjorie, Martha Coakley did not get the margin of victory that she would have wanted to have, and she was the conventional candidate for the Democratic nominee for governor. Clearly, they did decide to oust a veteran congressman, John Tierney, and they did not go for Warren Tolman, who we all know to be a very good guy and who was endorsed by the governor and the mayor of Boston. They instead went with a newcomer, Maura Healey. So there was a sense among the electorate that's, in my view, irrefutable that they were looking for something different, something new.
Did you have a picture at bostonglobe.com this morning? I didn't see it, of all the pollsters lined up on the Tobin Bridge. Did you have that, or did I see that? I mean, for people who are poll obsessed like I am, there was a lesson in last night yet again. In so many races, they could not have been more wrong. But can we return 1 second?
Hold that thought, Jim, though. But let's go to a Globe poll last week.
On the Healey-Tolman thing.
Yeah.
You're right about
Volpe,
that. Yeah,
who, when everybody had this race in a dead heat, and we did week before, Della Volpe grabbed the race, pointed out that that Maura Healey was really gaining steam, a 15 or 16 point advantage, and she nearly doubled that in the last week. So we did grab that one.
How much did you have Martha Coakley up?
You're breaking up.
Okay, so now, Brian, can we return to your brilliant idea? And I mean this sincerely. You know, the legislature is a very – all legislatures are reactive bodies. When there's a horrible – like the Jared Remy killing, all of a sudden they dealt with domestic violence, which they – in a way, which they should have done ages before. You are so right. If the implication of what you said is the horrible turnout on an important day like yesterday should cause these people to reexamine what they can do. And what they can do, you're right, is making voting easier for people, which doesn't excuse the non-voting. But I think that is really a spectacular idea, and we're going to push it. Thanks.
But, Jimmy, are you crazy? It's incumbents that benefit from the lack of a turnout for the most part. They don't want to change anything. It is so rare. It's been 22 years since an incumbent lost in a primary in Massachusetts for the U.S. House. So they don't want any change here. To your point, though, about the gubernatorial polling that we've been doing, did, in fact.
Did
peg Martha Coakley's vote tally. We're 1 percentage point off of her vote tally in our latest poll. What we didn't grab is that virtually every undecided in our poll would have broken for either Berwick, who was surprisingly strong.
Yeah, he was.
Or Grossman, who was really, really strong.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be I think there'll be a new appreciation. I mean, Deval Patrick is pretty popular already in Massachusetts, despite some of the failings of the agencies that he's overseen. But when you see Martha Coakley versus Charlie Baker, you realize that Deval Patrick is kind of that once-in-a-generation politician. I mean, just hearing these guys talk the day after the election, we're going to miss him, I think, when he's gone.
Well, you know, you said Martha Coakley versus Charlie Baker, and that raises the final electoral thing I want to broach with Brian. There are three independents who have qualified for the ballot. How do you decide, as the editor of the newspaper, what to do with these people? Obviously, there's Jeff McCormick, who is in the middle single digits in your polls, and has been losing staff, you know, one after another. Joe Malone, who left the Republican Party to become an independent, help him, left, according to the Globe, the other day. Evan Falchuk, low single digits. Scott Lively, who's basically built his political life on anti-gay activism, has registered as virtual zero, but they're all qualified for the ballot. What do you do about coverage of these people, Brian?
Well, there's a difference between qualifying for the ballot and being entitled to extensive news coverage, and it's an important difference. We will keep an eye on these candidates, and we will see if any of them are catching on in any way, if they're capturing the public imagination. But I think for the most part already we've seen that that hasn't necessarily been the case, but that doesn't mean that we will ignore them. We will keep an eye on this. We will check in with them. We will include them in our polls. But right now, you know, especially with McCormick, who probably would have seemed, at least on paper, to be the most serious or at least viable candidate, we've seen the opposite happening.
We're talking with Brian McGroy, who's the editor of the Boston Globe. Brian, let's move on to the series you guys have been doing on busing. It's the 40th anniversary of busing in the city of Boston, and you've done a multi-part series. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Shelley Murphy, one of the reporters who wrote this and reported this piece, was bused herself back in the 70s. I think I recall her telling me that when we used to work together at the Herald. But in any case, I wanted to give you a huge compliment because everybody knows or should know about the terrible racism and the attacks on these black kids coming into South Boston High School, the bricks thrown at the buses and the mobs around the buses and the glass and all that kind of stuff, and a very bad, bad moment in Boston's history. But you also delve into the class issue, which was great, and talked about, I think it was in the first series, about the Cassetta family. I think there were six or seven kids and a white family in South Boston, and one of their children was going to be bused to Roxbury. And the family wasn't crazy about it because they'd grown up in South Boston. The family had all gone to school in South Boston. They didn't like one of their kids having to ship across town. But the mother sent the child anyway. And then they got a phone call at one of the relatives threatening that if that young man, this white young man, got on the bus again to go to Roxbury, someone was going to blow his head off with a rifle. It was just a chilling tale.
That was, and thank you for your kind words on the first installment in our occasional series. We're pretty proud of what we did. Megan Irons, Jenna Russell, and Shelley Murphy put together a what we thought was a terrific narrative. It was a pretty unflinching look, actually a very unflinching look at the very first day of busing that we ran just ahead of the anniversary. The first day of busing, I think, is
12th.
Tomorrow.
12th. September 12th, Friday.
Friday. And so we're very proud of taking this look. What we did is, instead of trying to do an explainer 40 years later, what we did was bring people right back to that day. Many of us who were coming of age or had already come of age at that time, it's faded a little bit. And to bring back the memories, the emotions, to be honest, the ugliness of it all, was pretty eye-opening at this point in time. And they found some really, really, really good people to bring it back. Families that had children bused from Southie to Roxbury, families that went the other way. One guy who just kind of unknowingly put in for a job to drive the bus,
yeah.
Which was extraordinary.
This poor guy.
I don't know if you got a chance to click on, but the oral history that our .com people put together was really compelling. Interviews with activists. Ray Flynn was very prominent. The video that Scott LaPierre did was a 13-minute documentary, everything you need to know about busing, although the story itself was the most compelling part of it all.
You know, I just want to jump in about the bus driver. I think his name was Richardson. It was unbelievable. This poor guy shows up, you know, getting a job, 7 o'clock in the morning, drive the bus. He has no idea.
No idea.
And his bus is like swarmed, and he's mobbed, and he's telling the kids to hit the floor and stay away from the windows. I mean, the courage of a guy like this bus driver, and also these kids. I mean, I cannot imagine walking into that maelstrom. I would be afraid. I'd be afraid for my own children. The courage of the parents to send their kids. I mean, you captured all that. It was great.
Well, thank you.
And Brian, let me just add one thing. You said for those whose memories have faded, you and Marjorie were local kids who lived through this. I wasn't here
in Boston.
I know, but you were in Massachusetts.
Right.
A lot of us weren't in 74. And reading this about something about which we had only read is really, it is, to say eye-opening is too trite and insignificant, but it really is, it's great work. People should all check it out. Hey, Brian, for something completely different for a second. The other day, I was watching on CNN Michael Smirkanish, our former colleague at our other Radio Life. He was doing a show on CNN. One of the topics was, which I was not aware of, that a whole host of major national dailies – from the Washington Post's editorial page to last week, the New York Daily News have decided they will no longer use the term Redskins to describe the when they're talking about the Washington football team. It'll be the Washington football team or just Washington or that sort of thing. You guys aren't on the list yet. One, why? And two, how do you make a decision like that? Smirkanish, for whatever it's worth, was troubled by it, even though he's not a supporter of the term, because he thinks that that ends up having the newspapers make the news rather than the news making the news. Where are you on this?
Well, I'm a big fan of Smirkanish. He's I assume you got to know him in your past Radio Life.
Yeah.
Terrific guy. Very, very sharp. It just had a novel come out, by the way.
Called Talk. It's really fun about talk radio. It's great.
Look, we are looking at this issue here. We're actively looking at this issue, but I too am troubled by the idea of a newspaper making the policy for what a football team or a football league should be doing. The best solution of all is that the Redskins change the name or the NFL compels them to, and we wouldn't be in this situation. But it feels a little artificial to me for a newspaper like the Globe or any other paper to just simply ignore it, but that's not to say that we may not eventually get there. So it is under active discussion here.
Well, Smirkanish was interviewing the former head, I think, of the FCC a decade or so ago, and Smirkanish said very much what you said, Brian. But the guy said, well, listen, when African-Americans made clear we don't want to be called Negroes anymore— then the vast majority of newspapers, vast majority of media decided that was an appropriate change for them to make. So why isn't it an appropriate change here, I guess?
Well, it may be. It may be. And like I said, we're actively discussing it. It's just it's right now it's the name of the team. And, I think there's a shade of difference in terms of what the former FCC chairman was talking about. But it's something we're wrestling with. It's I wish I had an easier answer for you.
Well, you know, somebody described this, and I'm going to – this is a hard word for me to pronounce, but self-aggrandizing.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a great word, I think, to – if you are a critic of all these news organizations changing, saying – I think as you said in the beginning, it makes it seem a little bit like the newspaper is the story, the newspaper's being holier than thou, mm-hmm. and the newspaper saying we're above this kind of thing. And it, to some people, that may feel uncomfortable because it is still the name of the team. So it's a tough
one. I hear that. Hey, Brian, speaking of good things, you may be aware – I assume you are – that there's this new – part of the globe, it's called Crux or CruxNow.com, that is launching Thursday night with a stellar panel that is being moderated by Marjorie Egan. Right here. Do you want to tell people what this thing? I think it's great. I'm going, by the way. Tell us what's happening this week.
Well, we're really excited about this panel, but before I get to that, we're really excited about the launch of the website, if you don't mind. We got off to a terrific first week. Traffic was far higher than we anticipated it would be. Marjorie, you're column online at the moment on why you remain a Catholic is an utterly fascinating read. The imagery in it is from your father, 6'3", kneeling down beside his bed at night, a grateful man, was just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Your mother, who got to know all these elderly women and brought them food, and you didn't know how, but you just happened to know them, was just great. Just a great
boy, you read it, Brian. I'm impressed.
But it was also
thank
great.
You.
Let me interrupt you for a second. We were looking right after it went up. We immediately went to the comments section. The first comment is from Mexico City.
It was from Mexico City. You're
right. How great is that? But go ahead. I'm sorry, Brian.
So we've been very successful on this site in just a week in generating a national and, as you point out, even an international audience. So Thursday night, tomorrow night, we are kind of having an unofficial launch over at Boston College. Marjorie has graciously agreed to host this, to be the moderator. We couldn't be more excited about it. The Cardinal, Sean O'Malley, will be there as a speaker and a participant on a panel. John Allen, who is a very prominent staffer for Crux, for my money, the best Vatican correspondent in the world, at least in the English-speaking language, will be there. We have some academics on the panel as well. Marjorie will keep everybody in line and keep it all moving, and we're tremendously excited about it.
You know, John,
are you nervous, Marjorie?
I am. You know, I'm sitting across from the master moderator here.
Why
Jim,
am I
Jim
not moderating this thing?
And I've never met Cardinal O'Malley. So
you
I'm,
haven't?
No, I have not met Cardinal O'Malley, and so I've been critical of the church.
You're all adults. You
about
can do
200 times in the last year.
You understand, Marjorie, that the absolute only reason Jim Browdy is going to this is in the what he thinks is a the significant chance that we are going to call him up to the stage to help moderate.
Yeah, and your point is what?
I may need him.
Yeah.
I may need him. But, you know, this is what's so great about it. John Allen has unbelievable sources. He did this piece about Cardinal Dolan. It's very interesting because Cardinal Dolan
has been the
neocon, they used to call him. You know, the cardinal is very conservative. And, boy, what a great politician he is. And Allen nailed it completely. Well, now we have a new pope that is certainly not a neocon, that is much more, you know, live and let live kind of pope. And he perfectly captured how Dolan has cleverly done an about face with this new pope in town. He was at Fordham University, Dolan, with Stephen Colbert, giving this great performance. He's really funny, but he's also very clever in his about face. And I don't think anybody could get that interview.
No, and after the interview and the terrific story that John wrote last week, Cardinal Dolan tweets out that he couldn't be any happier that he was able to sit with his good friend John Allen. And everybody should go and read Crux. It was just a great moment.
That's great. Speaking of great moment, Brian, because we're running low on time, this is the moment of truth. We're finally going to put something to rest, thank goodness. Last week when you had promised us after we'd all been off, you know, for about a month, you're going to bring to the head this whole issue that matters to me and a lot of people in the region, why there's an A in capital instead of an O, which is what I think it should be. I made the mistake of saying that earlier on you had obfuscated about it and you got a little upset about it. And here's what you said.
Some apologies just come too late. And this, I believe, falls firmly in that category. So what I would suggest is you take a week to think about what you said to me, and why don't we revisit this next week when I'll give you the answer that I already have in my hand.
Oh, it's in your hand?
It's in my hand.
Okay, well, I did think about it. I did. My words were too strong. I do firmly apologize. I know you want to get this over with. So do we. So why is it capital with an A instead of capital with an O, Brian?
Well, let me just pull out my notes, Jim, so that I can make this very clear.
Wait.
No, yeah, go ahead. My producer, Chelsea's telling us, I can't believe this. Brian McGroy, we are out of time. We're not going to be able to do this
today.
We're out of time. She's telling me we have to go.
Well, that's a great big how do you do.
I apologize, Brian. We'll have to wait one more week for whatever the answer is. Brian, thank you for being with us in this suddenly aborted. Well, I'm sorry. It's the way it goes.
I'm utterly stunned. Jim, Archery, pleasure talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe joins us every Wednesday. Thank you very much, Brian McGroy. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We're going to be joined by Global Post Charlie Sennett for an analysis of Barack Obama's speech tonight, which WGBH will be covering live.
1-9-11, I should say.
And tomorrow is, of course, the anniversary of 9-11. Thank you very much, Jim. Our production team here at WGBH, our show, the production of WGBH, is Chelsea Merz, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer is John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I can't believe you stopped me from having Brian McGroy tell us what the answer was. But regardless, I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Please listen again tomorrow. Bye.